You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Each year, some of the world's greatest women explorers, scientists, and environmentalists are honored by an organization called Wings World Quest. And with me now are two remarkable women who have been so honored. Dalia Amorcande works in the Mayan forests of Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize. She monitors jaguars' health and well-being as an indicator of the effects of deforestation. And ethnobotanist Grace J. Gobbo is one of this year's winners. She studies traditional medicine practices in Tanzania. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to my show. Hello. Well, last night, Al Gore won an Oscar for a documentary about climate change. Do you think that the greater interest the world is paying to environmental issues might lead to more attention to the kind of work that you're doing, Grace? Well, maybe you want to answer that.
Well, I think I really would like to say that that movie has done a difference. Has done a difference even in different circles. People always thought I was crazy for what I was doing, working in the jungle and worrying about deforestation, not making any money. Why would you like to study that? And when the Al Gore movie came out, people start saying, oh, what you're doing makes a difference. Especially because the work that Grace and I would do is really focusing on the areas in the tropical rainforest and areas that are one of the most biodiverse regions in the world, and at the same time are very important carbon sinks to mediate global warming.
Now, can you tell us about your work with jaguars?
Well, what I do with jaguars is I'm just a little piece of a big puzzle. I work with different organizations in Guatemala, Mexico, and Belize. And what we're doing is a project that has been coordinated by a small Mexican NGO called Unidos para la Conservación. And what we have been doing is to first try to use the jaguar as an umbrella species to conserve the rainforest and to understand which had been the impacts of road construction and other infrastructure projects on deforestation, how it's affecting the jaguar conservation.
Well, first of all, jaguars, let's talk about them for a moment.
Okay.
These are big cats. These are the third largest cats in the world, aren't they?
Yes, and as well, it's not just a big cat, but it's the least known of the big cats.
Largest in the Western Hemisphere.
Yes. But it's very little known. We know a lot about tigers. We don't know a lot about leopards. We know about cheetahs. But about jaguars, they're so shy and so mysterious that is really few information about them.
Does that mean they're also not all that dangerous?
Well, they're not really dangerous to people. They don't attack people. They're very shy. But, for example, in terms of cattle, now we're having more and more problems. For example, in Guatemala, the NGO Defensores para la Naturaleza had been reporting that there are around four incidents per week of attacks for jaguar to cattle. And that is making more vulnerable the animal.
And that's because of the disappearance of the rainforest? You've been talking about Mesoamerica, but as I understand it, jaguars go all the way down into Argentina. So there have to be a lot of discontinuations of rainforests in that trip down there.
Totally. They go to Argentina, and they I don't know, in the New York Times was a few months ago an article that they found some jaguars in New Mexico. So the range of jaguars came from the U.S. to the south. And one of the biggest problems that we have now is forest fragmentation, and that populations are becoming isolated.
Well, do we know how far they tend to travel?
Well, that's why.
Because that's what you're studying,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly, and that's very exciting. What we do is, with a team, with the several teams I work with, we capture the jaguars, which is one of the most exciting and fascinating experiences you can ever have. Mm-hmm. We wake up at 3 in the morning with dogs. And Tony Rivera, who was a jaguar hunter, I should admit,
3 in the morning? Are they out at 3 in the morning? Is that
well,
why?
Well, the thing is, we have to wake up at 3 in the morning to see if they got the bait. We put different meat for bait. And we wake up in the morning in the jungle, and we check if one of the bait has taken. And if it has taken, we release the dogs. And the dogs start smelling and getting crazy and running and running and running. And the team of Tony, who is in charge of the captures, they start listening. And when they listen that the dogs are barking very high, they're running behind the dogs. I'm with the equipment behind, I shall admit it. And then when we start walking very slowly, and when we hear the dogs barking really high, is when we start running in the jungle to get. And when we arrive, usually the cat is in the top of the tree, and all the dogs are barking, and the cat is pretty shy in the top. Usually, sometimes if it's a male and it's big, sometimes they try to attack the dogs.
Well, we're talking about huge animals. They're like tigers, aren't they? They're just a little smaller than the African tiger and the Asian tiger and the African lion. We're talking about a big animal, and they're afraid.
They're afraid. Well, the thing is, they don't expect it. Unfortunately, we have to capture them and then recapture them again to take the radio collar, because the canopy of the rainforest is so dense that the GPS, that is the unit that takes the signal from a satellite and tell us how the jaguar moves, sometimes cannot cross the canopy. So what we do is we have to recapture the animal to get the GPS back with all the points, all the data points.
Because you're trying to find out how far these animals travel. Now, they're solitary animals, so that would make it even more difficult, because if they traveled in groups, it probably would be easier to figure out where they are.
They're solitary, but we have seen that, for example, females, their territory overlap. We have seen two females that we have been studying their movements, and we have been able to see that they overlap. Usually males, their home range do not overlap.
Now, why is the well-being of the jaguar so important? Does it have an effect on the larger ecosystem?
Well, as Alan Rabinovich say, who is a jaguar specialist, the jaguars is a top predator of the jungle. So if you ensure that you have viable populations of jaguar, you can really make sure that you have viable populations of all the ungulates and the prey that jaguar eats.
Which I assume are mostly rodents.
Eat tapir, which is a pretty big mammal. They eat the... oh my God, I don't know how to say it in English. They eat tapir, they eat the deers. The mm-hmm. deers are in the jungle. They eat rodents. They have a pretty variety diet. The people from the National University of Mexico, Miguel Amin, he has done a very interesting study analyzing fecal samples of the jaguar to see what they eat, and they have a pretty big diet. So if the jaguar eats, if you preserve the jaguar, you know you're preserving all the prey. And if all the prey is maintained, it's because all the vegetation that the prey eat is in well state. So that's what conservation biologists, we call an umbrella species.
And then there's the other factor, as you say, if they lose... If the system is thrown out of balance and they wind up attacking cattle and other things in areas outside the jungle.
Yes. Yes, and the problem is the human pressure is getting more and more in the jungle due to road development.
My guests are Dalia Amor-Conde, who works in the Mayan forests of Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize, monitoring jaguar health, and also ethnobotanist Grace J. Gobbo, who studies traditional medicine practices in Tanzania. And Grace, I'm assuming that in listening to Dalia, you're hearing certain things that resonate with you, because you're also concerned about the health of the ecosystem, in this case, through your study of plants. So as an ethnobotanist, what are you looking for? Are you looking for the relationship between plants and humans?
Yes, I'm looking at indigenous people, African people use the plants for, especially in the medicine part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the transfer of knowledge from elder people to the young people goes by oral, not written or documented, and with globalization now, young people are not interested in listening to the elders and high rate of environmental destruction. I felt like there's a high need to document this knowledge. And I believe, as Dr. Jane say, if only people know, they can care. So I feel like if we educate young people about medicinal plants, value of plants, leaving apart the other scientific knowledge about plants, but how our elder people use the plants for medication, for other ritual, I think maybe young people will care about the environment.
Now, a lot of talk over the years has been focused on the Amazon, where there have been many plants that have turned out to have had real medicinal value there. But I didn't know Tanzania. Is Tanzania particularly rich in rare medicinal plants?
Overall, Tanzania has got over 10,000 higher plant species. And just taking the example of where I'm working, that is western part of Tanzania, we have already documented over 200 species of plants, which has medicinal values. And I believe there are so many out there, and even I believe that there are some cures for these dangerous diseases like cancer and HIV AIDS, and we just need to go there and look and explore.
But what do you see as the biggest problem? The fact that some of these plants will disappear as humans start farming in these areas, or the fact that the traditions aren't being passed on from one generation to the next?
I think both. First of all, the rate of destruction, environmental destruction in Kigoma is more than 2%, which compared to the rest of Tanzania, which is 1%. And this has been because of the refugee influx from neighboring countries like Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda.
Because of political turmoil and
yes,
civil wars in those countries.
Yes, yes. But also the knowledge is really disappearing. And the mind of young people are just not into indigenous knowledge. People have other pastime like watching TVs, playing football, and not time to listen to the elders.
But this is also something that I think people could see as being of interest to modern scientists. This is where traditional medicinal approaches meet modern science. And aren't there young people in Tanzania who, other than you, who are excited by the prospect of finding a cure for cancer that some local person working in traditional medicine might have known as a result of having it passed down from generation to generation?
It's hard to say, because first of all, we have very few botanists in Tanzania, and particular ethnobotanists, there are very few. But my work and Jane Goodall's work, we encourage young people through Roots and Shoots program to get involved in traditional medicine and caring for environment and animals. Some staff whom I'm working with are also very much interested, but we don't have forum for ethnobotany. It's hard to share information.
Are traditional healers willing to pass on some of this information?
They are very willing.
Because some people like to keep their little trade secrets, don't they?
Yeah, but from my experience, they are very willing to share if there's somebody who is interested in it. And I interviewed more than 80 traditional healers, and they are willing to share.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more from ethnobotanist Grace J. Gabo and also from Dalia Amor Conde, who works with jaguars, both here because there's an event that I'll talk more about later. Grace Gabo is, and some of this year's honorees will join Jane Goodall at the American Museum of Natural History this coming Saturday, March 3rd at 1 p.m. The event is open to the public. And there, also there is will be Dalia Amorconde, who is a past honoree. And we will talk more about that also after we take this little break. We're back with Dalia Amorconde and Grace J. Gobbo, two of the honorees of a group called Wings World Quest, an organization that honors some of the world's greatest women explorers, scientists, and environmentalists. And before we move on, I want to talk a bit more about what the work that you're doing, Grace. But I wonder about being the whole matter of being honored as women. Do you think there'll ever be a time when that gender distinction will no longer be made, and they'll just say Grace Gabo is here? She's been doing this amazing work as an ethnobotanist. Do you look forward to a time like that, or do you think it's okay that people say woman scientist?
I think I'm looking forward to that because as a woman, I don't see much difference between men and women, especially, okay, maybe the biological difference, but we can do everything we want to do.
But does it affect your work in Tanzania, a country which has rather traditional sense of men's and women's roles?
Yeah, it affects a lot. Like, I was the first woman working with the Gombe Stream Research Center, and people were looking at me like, how can I be able to climb the hills and work all the day in the... But also when I go to the other plant expedition, I'm kind of, people are looking like, we should give Grace a easy job going shorter distances, but it really affect me. And yeah.
Well, Dalia, do you face the same kinds of unfortunate, I don't know if the word is discrimination, but unfortunate biases?
Yes, totally. I come from Mexico, and I think in that sense, Grace and I, we have similar issues. Developing countries, I think, still a lot the sense that women, we should be at home having kids and not in the field. Out working and it gets worse when you are leading an expedition and you have men working for you and they don't want to listen to you because you're a woman.
So were there role models that you had who inspired you, or is this something you just decided to do on your own because you came out of the right kind of family?
Well, the truth is my dad used to get National Geographic.
So that's it.
And I will never forget when it came in June of 1980. I was 6 years old. The first National Geographic was the son of Birut Galdikas, who studied the orangutans with an orangutan, a baby with an orangutan taking a bath. That was the thing. And I saw it.
She's been a guest on the show, so yeah. It was a great thrill for me to meet her.
So then I look at the pictures of her in the jungle, and my dad translated to me the article because now we have National Geographic in Spanish, but at that time we didn't have it. And I just learned English pretty late on my career. But my dad translated to me, and I was with my mom. Mom, what I'm growing up here? What I'm not growing up in the jungle with the orangutans? And then my dad started bringing me books of Jane Goodall. And this woman, for me, I don't know, they inspire me. And they have been a role model to say, okay, I can do this. And even if many people were like, you're crazy, what do you want to work on this? And especially big cats is something so male, you know, it's really for males. These women really inspire me.
So you're the only woman on many of these expeditions?
Well, no. Actually, I should say that now, for the NGO I work, the woman who is all the time in the field, because I'm doing all the computer analysis, which someone has to do it, is Danaya Suara, who is a Mexican, and we have Lucrecia, who is from Guatemala. So we have two women on the field, in the ground.
And Grace, you mentioned Jane Goodall's name a number of times. Was she one of the inspirations for you?
She's my inspiration up to now. And the fact that she came working in Tanzania when she was young, and even for British, by that time, a woman going out in a jungle alone was something. So she inspires me a lot. I should make correction when I say first female. I should say first Tanzanian female to work in Gombe, because there was British and Americans.
Yeah.
Also, yes, now there is another two women, African women, working in Gombe, so it's something coming up.
How old were you when you met Jane Goodall?
I was 24.
So you were already interested in doing this kind of work.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell us about some of the medicinal plants that you've studied? Are there some that look like they really can cure illnesses that we don't have any drugs for yet?
I haven't analyzed any of the plants, but I have. What can I say? People talking that they have been helped with certain medicine for tumors and for heart and many other diseases. Even now, people with HIV cases are coming up. The CD4 count is, they are coming up. They are not treated, yes, but it's like a local ARVs. We have already.
So,
there are 20 people.
So it helps build T cells in, mm-hmm. in the body?
Yes.
I am assuming that there are people from other parts of the world who are descending on Tanzania to look into that. Mm-hmm. Are there pharmaceutical people coming and saying, what have you discovered, Grace?
Not yet.
I know they're in the Amazon, they're in New Guinea, Papua, and some other places where some plants have been found to have medicinal qualities.
We haven't talked about it in public, and what we want to do first is to take the plants to the laboratory for pharmacological properties to be tested. That's when we can talk more about it. But now the traditional healers are doing experiments.
And you're talking to them and finding out what plants they would use what kinds of illnesses.
Yes, yes.
My guests are Grace J. Grobo, who is one of the winners of the Wings World Quest Award this year. She's an ethnobotanist. And also with us is Dahlia Amor Conde, who has won the award in the past. She works with jaguars in the what used to be called Mesoamerica, mostly the Mayan area. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And when you look at pre-Columbian art, the temples especially, the jaguar is everywhere. It was seen as the symbol of strength. You wonder, how did they even know about it if the jaguars are so reclusive?
Well, they're reclusive, but we need to understand that Mayans live all the time in the jungle, and they obviously had interactions, and actually to being able to capture a jaguar or to hunt a jaguar was something really special. And
it was a symbol of power.
It's a symbol of power, totally.
So this is something that is part of the culture. I don't know if you grew up with a sense of the jaguar as something special.
Well, I unfortunately grew up in a big city, in Mexico City, but I had the opportunity to live in Mérida, where are all these archaeological places. And I used to go with my parents all the weekends to different archaeological places.
To Chichen Itza and places
Chichen Itza, Uxmal, Calakmul, Divi Shaltun. There are so many. And the jaguar was something that always came up, especially the jaguar with the jade eyes that is inside of the Chichen Itza temple, which is totally beautiful.
So the whole fantasy of the jaguar then leads you into an interest on a scientific level.
Well, I was first doing science, and I was first studying biology in Mexico, and I start working on an NGO, and I start getting really involved in different conservation projects. And I didn't really start working with jaguars. I was working before with pronghorn antelope. And then my country, as your country, we have a lot of political problems and a lot of issues. And I start getting more and more involved working with indigenous communities. And the shock, the thing that made me change my career was when I was working in Oaxaca with indigenous communities as an observer on elections. They won the election against many problems that were on the time because of the political situation. And they saw me and they were like, oh, you're a biologist. We want to set up a protected area. Can you advise us? And I was like, oh, my God, I know about mitochondrial DNA of pronghorn antelope, but I don't have any clue how to work with these people.
But it also indicates that the indigenous people who we usually think of as wanting to hold on to older traditions, are very sophisticated about what's going on in the world, and they want help from people who can give them things that they can't get themselves. And I'm assuming, Grace, that's the same sort of thing that happened with you. But how did you wind up in this study, studying these things and working with traditional healers? There must have been some sort of a route that brought you there.
Yeah, it's true. First of all, being from Christian family, and my father being a doctor, when I grew up, and I knew there are traditional healers, and I associated traditional healing with evil, with witchcraft. And then when I was doing my botany course, there was ethnobotanical training, and that changed my conception because we went to the Maasai community, and
the Maasai community.
I thought
they lived in Kenya.
They live in Kenya and Tanzania and some part of Uganda. So we interviewed Remed for dry cough, and taking the plant to the laboratory, we found the antibacterial, antifungal properties which could help the cough, and that's changed my perception of traditional medicine and the witchcraft, and that people, indigenous people, don't know anything. They're just witches. And so I came back to Gombe and I started asking the elders who are working there about their perception of traditional medicine, and they shared their experience. That's when I said, I have to work something on that.
And we're seeing this all over the world. We're now seeing Western doctors looking into Chinese medicine, looking into ancient Mayan traditions, looking into Amazonian traditions, mm-hmm. looking into traditions all over the world. An important thing that fights cancer, ovarian cancer, was found in the American Northwest, and the indigenous people there knew about it, but... Mm-hmm. It took a long while for scientists to know about it.
From the rose periwinkle?
Yeah. So I guess we are eventually realizing that the traditional healers must have known something. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been trusted by the people who came to them when they were sick.
And they couldn't survive through all those years without modern medicine. And to me, I think it's... You know, they learn by experimenting it and experiencing it. So there are a lot more to learn from traditional healing.
I want to congratulate the both of you so much for the awards. Now there are a number of different celebrations that are going to be taking place. The biggest one on Saturday, but there are other things happening throughout the week. When do you receive your official award, Grace?
On Thursday.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, and when did you get yours, Dahlia?
I got mine in 2005.
Thank you both so much for being with us today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.